Welcome to Back from the Abyss. I'm Dr. Craig Heacock. I really like today's story for a number of reasons. First, our storyteller Rebecca is smart and funny, and she invites us into her story with such a wise and vulnerable voice. And I also love how Rebecca's story doesn't fit many of the common beliefs and tropes in psychiatry. Her story is one more piece of evidence that addiction is not always about trauma. Her story suggests that, rare as it is, there are young children without trauma or severe stressors who are endogenously depressed. And finally, her story is one more concrete piece of evidence that her purported DSM diagnosis of, quote-unquote, major depressive disorder is a completely unhelpful and basically meaningless way to think about her complex, non-bipolar spectrum out of the bell curve depression. Rebecca describes being born depressed, and this supposedly doesn't happen. But hang on for the conclusion of this episode where I posit my theory for her birth onset depression. We can't understand Rebecca in any meaningful way by giving her a diagnosis of quote-unquote major depressive disorder. As with all our patients, we can only understand the depression if we understand the whole story.
I was born the middle child of three children with two brothers, one older, one younger. My mom often said that I came out of the womb depressed. She said she had never seen a depressed baby before, but I was one. I wouldn't engage. I wouldn't smile. She said that what she had ended up having to do to get me to react to the world is she would just carry me around and talk to me constantly. And she said, finally, I began to smile and interact with people. But she always had this feeling that I was just like, ugh, really? I had to be born into this life. Even though, you know, I was born into a family that was filled with love. My parents were very family oriented. There was never any doubt in the world that I was wanted and loved. I was always told I could be whatever I wanted to be. Yet what I wanted to be was just not really present. And the only thing that I really connected with as a child was animals. We didn't have any animals in our house, despite my constant begging for some. So I would go hang out with the neighbor's cat. I would occasionally bring home any dog I could find that didn't have a person attached to it and claim it was my dog. My mom has this great story when I was 5 years old. She claimed I was dragging this dog into the house. And I was like, look, mom, it's my new dog. And she said, that dog belongs to somebody. And I said, not anymore. I don't know if that's true or not, but pretty much is about how I felt. My mom said that once I started going to school, she said she put me in school really early because she just didn't know what to do with me. She said once I started going to school that I acted more like a normal kid, that that I really loved school, and that certainly has been true for me throughout my life.
Were you like a super sensitive little orchid kid? You know what I mean, like the kind of kid that got kind of rocked by everything?
I was terrified of everything. I don't know that things really affected me more than anyone else, but I was just terrified of life. My mom also will say how when she tried to leave the house, I would just grab onto her leg and like literally not let go. She'd have to peel me off, which, as you can imagine, for a mom was made going out not that pleasant. But but with three kids, you know, occasionally you got to get away. So I don't know if that's normal or not, but I was just terrified of everything.
Except with animals.
And in fact, another story from my mom, which I kind of remember, is we had gone to play and we came outside and there was someone standing there with a Saint Bernard taller than I was. I ran over to it and threw my arms around its neck and hugged it. And my mom thought I was going to get eaten and just about had a heart attack. But luckily, the dog was okay with it. I just always felt like if there was an animal there, I was safe. And I never, despite the fact that we didn't have any animals, I wasn't scared at all of any creature I encountered, much to my mother's dismay. Yet it always went well. I had a connection with animals. I could understand when they were, I like intuitively knew if they were scared of me and would just sit there and not do anything until they came to me. So it was like I just had this connection. I was terrified of people and life, but animals were my safety and security.
I love that. How as a little girl, you really knew what you needed.
Yeah.
I think kids often do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I knew how to comfort myself. I knew what was going to make me feel safe. And eventually we did get a dog. That dog was definitely part of my security and who I went to. You know, I certainly wasn't going to go to a human, but I went to that dog and told that dog a lot of stories. I always excelled in school. I really did like school. I liked learning. I was very interested in biology and in animals. I was career focused from the time I was 5 years old for whatever reason. But I then decided I was going to be a veterinarian. I was going to be a zoo veterinarian. I had read a book, a little picture book about a zoo veterinarian, and that's what I was going to be. My parents said, well, you need to get good grades. So I got good grades. And on the outside, I looked like, you know, a good kid. I did my chores at home. I got good grades. But on the inside, I was suicidal from the time I was 10 years old. I did many things. One time I took like 10 aspirin and 5 extra strength Excedrin to, you know, in some lame suicide attempt. Boy, was I sick, but it didn't kill me, and I never told anyone about it.
Do you have a sense what was driving that, you know, with your adult self now and all the hard work you've done to try to understand yourself and make changes? I mean, look at that little 10-year-old girl. I mean, what exactly was driving that suicidality?
Yeah, it's so strange because it's not like at that point, really, nothing in my life was bad. I had parents who loved me. We didn't have a lot of money, but I certainly wasn't living in poverty and, you know, a shack somewhere. I went to a good school in a good town. There wasn't a lot of, you know, violence. There was nothing to be afraid of. So I really kind of believe that there was some sort of chemical imbalance there because I don't really, like today, if I think about those times when I tried to kill myself. There was no precipitating event. There was nothing really horrible that I was trying to escape from. I just didn't want to be in the world. I used to, around that same time was when I started writing this really dark poetry. Like, I don't know where it is now, but I do remember coming across some many years ago and being like, oh my God, like this just about how horrible life is and, you know, how much I wanted to end it all and, you know, why? Like even today, I think, why? Nothing was that bad. It was a normal childhood.
Because typically I would think of a suicidal 10-year-old is almost surely having trauma as the main driver. But again, as you and I've talked about before in our work together too, that it really seems like you were kind of born with this whole sort of endogenous depression, suicidality circuit. I don't know, like it unfolded so early.
Yeah, it's very, very strange when I think about it. I started cutting myself around the same time. Now, this was in the days before social media. So I didn't know that anybody else had ever thought of this before. You know, I was quite surprised later on to find out that it was a thing and, you know, actually a little disappointed that I hadn't, you know, invented the cure-all for emotional pain. And really the driving thing behind that was, you know, when I created physical pain, I would not feel the emotional pain. And I mean, I guess that's probably the same reason everybody does it. But the interesting thing, though, is that I used to, you know, cut on my wrists a lot, you know, not certainly, maybe in some vague, someday down the road, I'll really attempt to kill myself sort of way. So I always had cuts on my wrists. And I remember my mom noticing it at one time And I just blew it off and said, oh, I don't know, I did this. And she never mentioned it again. And I was a little more careful about hiding it. But like you'd think, I thought there certainly were clues here that maybe a parent should have picked up on and said, maybe I should get this child some help.
So you think your family didn't have any idea how miserable and depressed you are
from
heading into puberty and adolescence?
I think that they didn't really have a clue. You know, I performed well in school. I was kind of quiet. I had friends. You know, it wasn't like I was this loner child. I was popular in school.
Maybe high performing was critical. Because again, you know, you and I are about the same age. You know, I think in the 70s and 80s, if you look like you were doing well, you must be well.
Yes, exactly. Certainly no one was going to go any deeper than that. It just wasn't done. People didn't go to get therapy in those days. In fact, my mom, till the day she died, thought people who took antidepressants were weak. You know, people who went to therapy were weak. I remember we had many discussion about it. I'd go, Mom, you realize I'm on antidepressants, go to therapy, right? And she'd be like, oh yeah, I'm not talking about you.
Oh, you got a special exception.
That's exactly.
That's so good of Mom.
I know. Thank you, Mom.
How and when did drugs and alcohol enter the picture?
I first got drunk and smoked pot when I was 13. At a friend's house, we were going to a dance, and it was really the first time that it was kind of available. And wow, did I overdo it, and boy, was I sick. I certainly, at that time, didn't think that it was the cure-all to everything. I was just like, whoa, I was sick. However, the very next time the opportunity came up, which was soon thereafter, I found out that if I didn't drink quite so much, that I would automatically feel better. And in fact, very early, I think I was 14 when I first tried Coke. And boy, did I love that drug. I immediately was like, wow, I feel great. And I had not felt great really ever that I could remember. You know, there were times I felt better than others, but it was like drugs and alcohol were the answer to all my problems. Now I could still be successful in school and have friends and all of that, but now I could actually feel good. You know, I had a reward for all this misery. I had a way out of the pain. I immediately stopped cutting. I immediately stopped focusing on suicide. I had a way out, and I was like, wow, you know, why has nobody ever talked about this before?
They should teach this in school.
Exactly. My parents should be giving me this, for God's sake. But also, you know, my dad was very controlling. And from the minute I turned into an adolescent girl, especially since I showed signs of maybe going to the wild side, boy, he was going to lock me in a closet if that's what it took. It was a constant fight throughout my teenage years of him, you know, trying to lay down the law and so help me God if I came home late. And then I'd be grounded, you know, for a month. Whereas my brothers could pretty much do what they wanted. But my dad, he was a firefighter and he worked in emergency. And I'll never forget, there was this one instance. I was probably 13 or 14. He had gone to an accident of a girl who had just gone out with her boyfriend and they were in an accident and both were killed. It was one of the two times I ever saw my dad cry. He sat at the dinner table, talked about it, and was crying. Boy, did I hear that story approximately 500 times during my teenage years, because that wasn't going to happen to me. If he could have gotten away with it, I do believe I would have been locked in the china closet throughout those years. My dad says I was the cause of all of his gray hairs and hair loss. I believe it, but, you know, I at the time, if you told me, well, if my dad told me that I shouldn't do something, I knew it was a thing that I wanted to check out. I used to joke with my friends that I just listen to my dad's lectures and take notes. Smoking cigarettes is bad, you say? That sounds like fun. My dad says pot is evil, must smoke. You know?
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I was, you know, right from the get-go. First of all, these things saved my life, so I don't know what you're talking about. Clearly, you don't know. And second of all, I was a teenager and immortal. If I died, you know, so what? I'd been spending, you know, my whole lifetime trying to die. I wasn't really that afraid of it. Mm-hmm. So I had that going for me, too. So I found my solution, and I continued to drink a lot, do coke whenever I could throughout high school and college. But I also had great ambitions. I was going to be a veterinarian. And to do that, you know, so I had this kind of dual personality going on. I graduated fourth in my class in high school. I was an A student. I got many a talk from people at the school about the people I hung out with. They were concerned because I hung out with not the straight A students, let's just say. They at least were a little concerned about the company I kept, as was my dad.
When did things start going off the rails?
Things didn't really start going off the rails until my last year in college. In college, I continued to drink a lot, do a lot of drugs. But at the end of my freshman year, we were doing LSD. It was my idea. It usually is. And I found out where to get some. And one of my friends who had never done it before, I talked him into it. Me and my best friend and him, we were inseparable freshman year. My roommate had moved out and they both kind of moved into my dorm room. We pushed the beds together and all three of us would just sleep in the beds and they would sleep in and I'd get up and go to class. And I was always really mad about that. So we were all going to do some acid and we all did. I took more than anybody else because, you know, I had extra. I didn't know what to do with it. So I just took it. Unfortunately, he went a little crazy on the acid and he jumped off the roof and died. And at that point, it was my first experience with not only grief, but also real shame. I felt like it was my fault. I had given him the drugs and a lot of people felt that way as well, which didn't help. So at that time, I was experiencing this grief and also experiencing the reality of what my dad had said to me all those years. You know, drugs can kill people. And so I swore I was never going to do it again. You know, drinking was okay, though. So I continued, you know, on my merry way with frat parties and drinking on the weekends. But it didn't last because really, I only really felt okay when I was doing drugs. Drinking, really, it was okay, but it didn't make me feel good. It wasn't until the last year of college that I became friends with someone at work who I later found out was a heroin addict. And me being me, I'm like, I'd like to try that. So I did, and I think I was addicted from the first second I tried it. That drug, as opposed to every other drug that I ever did, coke was still, you know, pretty high on the list, but the second I took that drug, I felt like everything was okay. No matter what, there could have been a bomb exploding in the next room and I would have been okay with it. It was the first time in my life that I ever felt that everything was okay. And of course, being very addictive and that state of mind being very addictive, I was very quickly addicted to it. I spent the last year in college trying to get good grades while trying to acquire money for these drugs and get these drugs every day. It was pretty difficult, and I knew I was in trouble, but I didn't know what to do about it. Eventually, I graduated from college. At that time, I had...
You're still doing well.
Yes. Well, at the time I graduated, I had decided that I would go on methadone to try and treat it. So I was on methadone, but I was still using drugs, you know, here and there. But at least I didn't have to go get drugs every day. And in fact, as my dad pointed out later, imagine what your GPA would have been if you hadn't been doing drugs, as good as it was while doing drugs. Anyway, it was enough to get me into vet school, but not until later.
Which is very hard, because in general, veterinary school is harder to get into than medical school.
Yes.
So you're going through college, heavily using drugs and addicted, and that now heroin, and yet you're doing well enough that you're getting ready to apply to veterinary school.
Yes. And I did, in fact, apply to some vet schools towards the end of college, but I just knew I couldn't go to vet school like this. There was no way that I was going to be able to get through vet school shooting heroin every day. Wasn't going to happen. At that time, I actually didn't get in. I got waitlisted at three schools. I probably could have gotten into one of them, but I didn't follow up because after graduation, my roommates called my parents and told them I was using heroin. So instead of going to vet school, I went to detox and then went to rehab, followed by a halfway house. At the time, I was still depressed and it still was untreated. I'm not sure that it was even really recognized as I went through detox and treatment. And again, at that time, it wasn't a thing that people really identified or focused on. You know, 50% of the population wasn't on antidepressants. Mm-hmm. I did go to some counseling while I was in the halfway house, but never saw a psychiatrist, never had anything
diagnosed. I'm guessing you're probably getting the message that, hey, if you stop all these drugs and alcohol, you'll feel well.
Yes.
Which is true for lots of people.
Drugs and alcohol were my problem. Mm-hmm. And when in reality, although drugs and alcohol certainly became my problem, the reality is I was treating my own depression with these highly addictive drugs. I got clean. I started working at a vet clinic. I reapplied to vet school. I got into vet school. And throughout vet school and the years after, what happened was I became really anorexic. And
did that replace the addiction?
Yes, yeah. Because the thing about being anorexic is then you can measure your worth by the scale. And as long as the scale's going down, you're okay. Mm-hmm. If it starts going up, well, then you're bad. But you have things to do. You're going to cut out this food group and this food group and this food group, and it just gets narrower and narrower and narrower until you're eating a couple grapes and a handful of air-popped popcorn a day. But eventually, and this was something that repeated several times throughout my life, eventually you get to the point where you're actually starving to death. And then you have to make a decision, and people are starting to harass you because you look like you just got out of Auschwitz. And then you either have to do something about it, which everybody is harassing you to do, or just tell everybody that, hey, I'm just going to sit here and die. And you start feeling the effects of the oncoming death. Like I remember I would start to, at night, get these random like whole body tremors. And of course, you're really weak and really tired and stand up and you almost pass out. And that's kind of normal as you get lower in body weight. But you still have to exercise. Any calorie that you eat, you have to exercise enough to burn that calorie. So that was the rule. If I ate 400 calories, I had to burn 400 calories at the gym. So there's all these rules, you know, in my head, of course, of what I can do, what I can't do. And that's kind of what I focus on. And it gives me something to focus on and a way to be like, oh, everything's okay. I lost 5 pounds, you know.
I mean, did it actually keep you away from drugs and alcohol?
Oh, yeah.
So you just went right from cocaine, alcohol, heroin, boom, over to anorexia.
Not Not exactly that linear. While I was in treatment and while I was in vet school, I had other things to focus on. Food was here and there a thing. I certainly would always go on these crazy diets, but I never took it to the extreme that I did after I graduated from vet school. And usually any time of the multiple times when I became anorexic, any time when I became seriously anorexic, there was always a trauma that preceded it. It didn't necessarily have to be a huge trauma. Like I remember in vet school, this cat that I really, really loved died. He was only 1 year old and I had saved him as a baby kitten at work. That was what triggered the, because then I was depressed and didn't eat for a few days. And then I was like, well, I need to lose some weight. I could not eat some more. And that was usually how it started. And then how it always ended was I was so skinny that I was starting to be able to physically not function well and people were harassing me. And then I would go into therapy and I would make a decision that I had to eat and it was very uncomfortable. And
I can imagine that it's counterintuitive for people to hear that you were treating your depression with anorexia, because it kind of makes sense, drugs and alcohol.
Sure.
But maybe say a little bit more about that. What was it actually doing? Because again, you know, you've been so sad and miserable and scared for essentially your whole life. But then you find starving yourself as a way to feel better.
It's sort of the same sort of thing as cutting yourself as a way to feel better. It gives you something to focus on, like besides how miserable your life is or the feelings that you're feeling. So the feeling of hunger is always present and you're obsessing about food but not allowed to eat it. And so it keeps your mind off of like actual life. And, you know, in my mind, which again doesn't make sense, I'm a veterinarian, I'm successful, I have a great job, people think great things of me, I have great potential. That's something that I've always heard my whole life, especially from my dad. Such great potential. And there you are wasting it as a heroin addict.
Yeah. Well, it's almost like as you became more and more accomplished in your career and did your fellowship and got more and more acclaim and were, you know, reaching the pinnacle of where you could be as a veterinarian, your other things followed along and got even worse.
Right.
You know, you got sicker as you got more accomplished.
True, because I didn't have anything to treat this depression. And I always thought that once I got to my goal, I was going to be okay. So once I got there and I wasn't okay still, then the depression would set in even harder. You know what? You're actually never going to be okay. And you still want out of this life. And you can't use drugs. And so how else you're going to get out of it? The other thing about starving yourself is it really is a slow method of suicide, you know, and it's more subtle. Like sometimes I even thought about it this way, you know, I know killing myself would be so incredibly damaging to the people who loved me and my family. So how about, I'm not going to actively end my life, but I'm not going to do anything to support it either. So eating is supporting life. So if I just don't eat, eventually I'm going to die. But it's not like I really killed myself. And that's why, you know, when you come actually to the point of, all right, now you are going to die. So you still probably realistically, it was always when I got under 100 pounds. And then I'd be like, I'd really, really be feeling the effects of starvation. I probably could have lost another 20 pounds before I actually died. But it was the time when I always had to make that decision. Am I going to live and try and do something about this or am I going to die? And that's always when I would start therapy. A couple of times people started antidepressants, but I would take them for a while. It would make me feel better. And then I just stopped taking them. Stop going to therapy.
Plus, antidepressants tend not to work very well at all if you're starving.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did that evolve? You know, you're theoretically doing well in your career. You're slowly starving yourself to death.
Yeah, and people at work would be like, you know, especially when I got really skinny, they kind of feel it necessary to say something. And it always was, you know, like, hey, we've noticed that you really don't eat and you're really skinny and is everything okay? And so it would start to get a little uncomfortable because then I'd be exposed. You know, now people are seeing a manifestation of how I actually feel. And that's very uncomfortable because the persona that I present at work is certainly not how I feel inside. And at work, I'm a competent, you know, professional, and I've got my shit together. But reality is I don't at all. I've never felt okay. I'm still not okay. I'm just going to deal with it a different way. When that way starts to become apparent to the general public, then in one sense, I'd be like, especially I think with my family and my husband and people close to me, I would at that point be like, oh, wow, you never noticed before that things weren't okay. And I'd be angry about it. Now that I weigh 98 pounds instead of 100, you're concerned. Like, you didn't notice, especially with my husband, you didn't notice I haven't been eating for 6 months. And also, when you first start losing weight, you get a lot of acclaim. Oh, wow, you look great. And then all of a sudden, it's people are uncomfortable and they don't know what to say. So I played out that scenario several times. And then at one point, I was pretty thin at this time too, actually. I was diagnosed with hepatitis C. So it turns out my drug use in college, I had managed to pick up hepatitis C. Fortunately, not HIV. And so I began treatment with interferon. Interferon is well known to cause severe depression. During that treatment, I went to all new depths of depression. And I was so convinced that not only would I be better off, but the whole world would be better off if I was dead. And again, no reason for it. I still had a great job. I was at the end of my residency doing well. And there was no reason. I had a great house. I had, you know, everything.
Probably knowing you, you had like 35 animals.
I had a lot of animals. I think at the time that was I had acquired some cats at that time. I had 10 cats, 2 dogs, and 2 iguanas. But yeah, so I had some animals. And really, the only reason, and this has been true several times throughout my life, the only reason I didn't kill myself was because particularly my dogs were so attached to me. And I thought it would be awful to leave them. You know, they would be so sad. I was more worried about my dogs than I was about my parents, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Fast forwarding a bit, I eventually relapsed because I came to the point where I decided I felt so bad that I was either going to kill myself or do something to feel better. And there was one thing that I knew that could make me feel better.
Did your relapse pull you out of anorexia?
When I relapse, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Food becomes a non-issue. And usually when I'm doing heroin, you know, you're not that hungry, but I'll tell you, I eat more on heroin than I do when I'm anorexic. So usually that wasn't a big deal, but absolutely. I gained weight when I relapsed because at the time I was at a pretty low body weight. And yeah, I got to, you know, a fairly normal, low normal body weight mm-hmm. after I relapsed. Mm-hmm. So after I relapsed, it sure did solve my problem of not feeling good, but I very quickly, once again, realized I was in deep trouble. And I couldn't not use drugs, even if I was at work. And I knew that I couldn't function effectively, and I was responsible for these animals' lives. And so I consulted a physician who specialized in addiction. And he recommended that I go into treatment and also that I report myself to the board and get into a monitoring program. I did both of those things, but before I went into treatment, I had decided I was just going to do it on my own and found out, as usual, that I'm absolutely incapable of stopping on my own. I have to go to a place where I am separated from that drug physically for a period of time in order to stop. And it certainly wasn't due to lack of willpower or anything else. I tried everything and I couldn't do it until I went to treatment. At that time, I thought, you know, if my license is on the line, I surely won't use drugs. And that's why I followed his advice and reported myself and got into this monitoring program, because obviously that would keep me clean. However, that wasn't true. I still couldn't stop using. Because I had voluntarily reported myself, when I came up positive, they said, you can go to treatment, you can still keep your license, but if this happens again, we're taking your license away. So I went to treatment, I stopped using for a period of time. I was still trying to work, I was still trying to be the perfect person there. I was preparing to take boards, and I couldn't stay clean. And so I lost my license. And at that point, I pretty much lost everything. I could no longer, I was divorced, living by myself at my house with 5,000 animals. At this point, I had lost a lot of cats. I only had 2 cats left. I still had the 2 dogs and 1 iguana. I didn't know what to do. I went to rehab. When I got to that rehab, they had a therapist or a psychiatrist there who everyone was required to see. And I went to see him and I said to him, you know, I said, I can't even be bothered to kill myself. I don't care if I live. I don't care if I die. I don't care if I stay here. I don't care where I go. You know, I just don't care. And he said I was probably the most depressed person that he had ever seen in his life. I had been on antidepressants since I was on interferon. They weren't really doing much. He added something else in and I just kind of maintained, but nothing really worked. I was still very suicidal. I still couldn't stay clean because why should I? I've now lost everything. I had no veterinary license. I had no money. I was going to lose my house, my car, everything. I had these animals that I was taking care of. I ended up euthanizing one of my dogs who had an illness that required a lot of steroids. And truth is, he was very aggressive on the steroids. He always had those kind of tendencies. But I truly believe that he went crazy because I went crazy. He attacked a couple people and one day he attacked me and I ended up euthanizing him. And that was heartbreaking. When I lost my house and lost everything, I ended up going into a halfway house and I had to find places for all my animals. The cats went with my ex-husband. My dog went and stayed with somebody temporarily till I could get on my feet. And this dog was my life. Mm-hmm. My iguana went to be taken care of by someone else that I knew, and she died after a month there. Again, probably because she didn't have all the exact requirements that she had when I took care of her. Mm-hmm. Now, talk about being depressed. I've caused the death of 2 of my animals. My dog is miserable without me. The guy keeps calling me and saying, you know, finally he was like, she's so depressed, she just lies there. She won't even eat anymore. And I really wanted to die. But someone that I had met while I was in the halfway house who was a vet tech said, I'll take your dog. You can come over and see her and, you know, then get her back whenever you're able. And that was life-saving. She had 2 other dogs. My dog fit right in. She would do things like she said she would start to lie around and I'm like, she likes to play chase me, so start to chase her. So this poor girl chasing my dog all around, and indeed it would make her happy. She'd perk up and run around and play. And then I would come over every weekend, and it really thank God, made things bearable until I could move out on my own and take her back, which I did. Then I was stuck with myself. Like, I can't use drugs. Like, I had to file bankruptcy. I lost my house. I lost my car. My family wouldn't speak to me. They very much were ashamed of me. They didn't want anybody to know that they had a daughter that was a drug addict. So I just kind of ceased to exist. I remember it was really embarrassing, actually. I, at the time, was working at a lab. And one of the guys at work knew my dad. And one day he came to me and he looked kind of weird. And he said, "Oh, your dad was in the newspaper. I thought you might want to see it." And he handed it to me. And I read the article. And it was about him. He was a firefighter going into some burning building and saving a child or something. And in there, he said that he had one son who was a firefighter and one son who lived in California, and no mention of having a daughter. So it was both reinforced, you know, what I already knew and what I already felt was that, you know, I was dead to them now, but also was really embarrassing because now this guy at work was like, what's going on there? And so I was very ashamed of everything. I, at the time, was just on antidepressants, not really going to therapy. Nothing was really working. And I ended up relapsing again because what else could I do? I was so miserable. And so I talk about it as the rehab tour of America. I went to rehabs in 5 different states. Mm-hmm. And every time I would stay clean for a little bit and then I would just go back to using because I already didn't have a license anymore. You know, how much worse could it be?
I think you make a good point there that even if those rehabs were doing their job, like giving good treatment, whatever that is, you would leave with no purpose. You've lost essentially everything.
Right.
How could you not go back?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess the thought was that I would continue to get help and learn to be valuable just as I am without all this extra stuff. But it never happened. And I only knew a couple ways of dealing with this, starving myself to death or using drugs. And it was so, so hard to put down the drugs this time. And I lost absolutely everything, which is why there ever after I say I would rather kill myself than do drugs again. And, you know, that was the point where I was at that time, kill myself or do drugs. And I chose drugs. And if I had to choose again, I'd probably kill myself. I don't know how I was fortunate enough to finally get some help. I started seeing a therapist regularly and actually working on the causes of depression. I knew now that I'd rather kill myself than go back to drugs. But I still couldn't deal with life. I still was just felt worthless and like life was worthless. So what does a person do in that situation? I'll get my PhD. That's always worked for me before. Now I have a goal. And when I liked research when I was doing it, when I get my PhD, surely I will be better. So I came to Colorado and did a combination, because a PhD wasn't really enough. So I did a combination microbiology residency and PhD and did a lot of research, did really well, did great in my courses, excelled at everything as I do, still while feeling like I'm the biggest piece of shit that ever existed. Mm-hmm.
But not using drugs.
But not using drugs. Mm-hmm. Nope. Just staying busy, doing my stuff, knowing that when I'm done with this PhD, things are going to be better. Mm-hmm. However, I came to the close to the end of being done with that PhD and things weren't better. I did start drinking again. I had my license back at this time. I did start drinking again as a way of, like, I know I can't do drugs. Maybe I could drink and it'd be better. But drinking just didn't do it for me. I still wasn't feeling better. I had a great job that I loved in addition to working, getting my PhD. At one point, I had been on this ketone diet because I was going to lose some weight. You're not allowed to drink alcohol on a ketone diet, you know, because it's a sugar. So I hadn't drank all summer. But I was traveling. I really wanted to sleep on the plane because I knew I wasn't going to get any sleep where I was going. And I had a couple glasses of wine. And boy, did I feel it because I was not eating. And it was the first time I had alcohol in a while. And it was really late at night. And I'm driving 2 hours really late at night to a hotel. I end up getting into a little accident. It's in these back roads, way backwoods. And this cat runs across the street and I swerve and I hit a curb. And I'm so naive, I call the police because I'm out in the backwoods and my car is not drivable. Like, you can drive it a little bit, but I'm like, there's no way I'm going to get where I'm going. Well, the police come and arrest me for DUI. My blood alcohol content was only 0.09, but, you know, I guess that's all you need. I was going there for my job. So I get fired from this job, which I really love. And once again, I find myself in this place of, all right, now I have nothing again. Not really, but in my head. I've lost this job I love. I'm gone to school. I've milked the school thing for about as long as I can. Like, I'm going to have to do real life now. And I still just want to die. And so I'm already starving myself. So I just continue on down that road.
I think you and I started working together a few months after this.
Yep. Yeah. We did. And I believe that I came in and told you my life was already over. You know, I was just waiting to die. At that time, you know, I don't even know why I came to see. It all came about serendipitously because I was friends with somebody who was coming to see you. I wasn't even sure I wanted help, you know. I came to you because I'm like, I suppose I should do something. But I was really just ready to be done. I knew that using drugs wasn't the answer, and I was very firm in my conviction that I would rather die than use drugs. But dying really didn't seem like such a bad thing, you know? So that, again, was where I made that conscious decision. Well, if I'm not going to actively kill myself, because, again, I've experienced suicide multiple times by now, I know how it affects people. But I don't have to actively support my life. So I just stopped eating and started coming to see you. And you pointed out that I might be a little depressed. But I was like, yeah, I know. You know, I've done a bunch of things. I'm on some antidepressants. It doesn't help. So I give up. I'm not sure exactly what clicked. I guess I felt like, all right, might as well give this life thing a try again. Just for the record, okay, I'll go out saying I tried my best, everyone. You talked about ketamine therapy, and I honestly believe that ketamine therapy has been one of the things that has turned my mental state around. Of course, being a good drug addict, you know, we kept trying and it kept doing nothing. And till I got to a quite high dose. And, you know, I've tried a lot. I was trying to describe it to somebody today. She was like, oh, you got ketamine yesterday. I'm like, what's that all about? And what's it like? I don't really know. To me, it feels kind of like speed processing. Like I really, not even under my control, start to deeply process some of the things that are like the core things of what keeps me stuck in that depressed state. And I come out of it always with a new understanding about something different that seems like maybe it wouldn't be so hard to realize. But I could never make that connection in my brain. And because I couldn't do anything differently. And so like what has actually worked to treat my depression has not been any one thing. It has been a combination of things. And I always, especially with my anorexia, but in general, was very into physical fitness because I knew that made me feel better. It was one of the things that I could do besides using drugs that would temporarily make me feel better. And it still remains a cornerstone of what I do today to keep my mental state in check or my depression in check.
It's like you've learned later in your adulthood, you've learned how to take care of yourself. Because you've always been really good at taking care of animals.
Yep.
That's been your life's calling of all species and sizes and medical problems. And you've taken care of yourself with, you know, starving yourself and with drugs and alcohol. But I think, I agree with you. I think what's changed in the 4 years we've been working together is that you have learned that you need to eat and you need to work out and you need to sleep and that you need to have connections. And you and I have a really sweet connection, and ketamine's been helpful and meds have been helpful. So it's been a whole bunch of things.
Yeah.
But really, I think arguably your biggest strength is you have such a heart for animals, and you knew that even as a little kid, and you've poured so much energy into that, and that's kept you alive, but it didn't help you thrive. And it's, right. I think it's been only in the last few years that you've realized, you know, you have to take care of yourself. You have to let me take care of you. You have to let the people who care about you take care of you. And it's working.
It is working. It's so strange. And, you know, it's funny that you say that because sleep was always, you know, definitely dispensable. Very early on in my career, because I was going to be the best of the best, you know, I would go from one job to the next. I sometimes worked 48 hours in a row. I didn't need to sleep. Sleep was for pussies, just like food. And the interesting thing, even though I definitely would take an animal over a human any day, but I'm also very good at taking care of people. Throughout my life, you know, I have taken care of other people and did a really good job of it. You know, I've taken care of people, both my parents, as they left this life, a very difficult job, especially for my mom, who had a prolonged horrible illness. I'm really good at making sure that they eat and sleep and that, you know, my animals eat and sleep and, you know, everybody else. But for me, it's almost like, I didn't need it because I was better than that. It's like this kind of egomaniac with an inferiority complex. You know, I didn't need that because I was better than that. But at the same time, I didn't deserve it because I was a piece of shit. Something so simple like making sleep a priority, which is very difficult in this career. Mm-hmm. You know, I went into emergency and critical care. Like, you know, animals get sick in the middle of the night. And my mom used to say, because I always, as a baby and a child, I always had trouble sleeping at night. I always wanted to sleep all day and be up all night. And she used to say from the time I was 10 years old that I was going to be the only vet with an all-night vet clinic. And I turned that into a career. However, you still have to get up in the morning. So that backfired a little. I think, you know, like thinking back to my parents, I guess, you know, my mom had an eating disorder. That's where I learned that particular tool. She certainly never took care of herself. She was always caring for other people, but she was a stay-at-home mom. You know, it's harder to care for people when you have a big, very demanding job.
Mm-hmm. I remember I had met you before we started working together treatment-wise, and I remember you talking about your skunk. And now knowing, yes, like back in those days, you were not taking care of yourself at all. But I remember thinking, she has a skunk that she takes care of. And I just thought that's such a great example of who you are, that you would take in all comers, all species welcome.
All species
welcome. All species welcome. Yeah.
Even the smelling ones.
Even the smelling I've worked with many patients over my career who have said that the only thing that healed their sexual trauma, the only thing that healed their depression, at least for an hour or two, was heroin. I think this speaks to the profound importance of the endogenous opioid system, of our wonderful innate biochemical ability to give ourselves a warm and empowering hug by way of our own endorphins, a predictable yet magical way to allow us to feel okay in the world. My guess is that Rebecca was born with some kind of deficit in her endorphin system, resulting in her inability to feel held or safe or loved by the people around her, and also making self-soothing nearly impossible. But then came the irresistible comfort of companion animals, and eventually, the ultimate salve, opioids. You can help this podcast by sharing episodes, by writing us a review on your favorite podcast platform, and also by reaching out to us with your comments and questions and suggestions. You can contact Chris and me through my website, craighecockmd.com.